Good day, everyone. This is the virtual panel session number 5 for Ontology Summit 2013. It's Thursday, February 14th, and we are pleased to be featuring the session under the topic Software Environments for Evaluating Ontologies. This is the first of two sessions under this topic. I am Peter Yim, co-convener of Ontolog and also from CIM3, and co-chairing this session with me is Dr. Michael Denny from MITRE. So if everyone would go to the slide deck that is labeled Zero Chair, let's move on to slide number 2. I'm reiterating the TRACD mission statement. TRACD is on software environments for evaluating ontologies. Essentially, through this track, we are aiming at coordinating a few things. One is to provide a venue to bring together individuals and communities who can help define and advance the state of the art in software and systems for evaluating ontologies. While the other tracks deal with intrinsic aspects of ontologies, extrinsic aspects of evaluating ontologies, and quality and methodologies for evaluating ontologies, our track focuses on the software side of things, especially when they're being implemented or has been implemented. And we look at software environments, software systems, software tools that feature ontology evaluation. We will also be collecting and enumerating software environments and tools that supports ontology evaluation. And of course, given the open community aspect of the groups that we are dealing with, our emphasis would be on those that are open efforts and those tools that are publicly available. Although to bring people a full spectrum of what is out there, we also invite and welcome commercial organizations who have proprietary technologies that are willing to share it with us. I mean, on conditions that they are at least making available their presentations and the presented material as publicly shareable material. We are also going to be doing investigations and development works like software prototyping and implementation during this summit, and track is also tasked to help coordinate and facilitate some of those things. A few of you would have heard of, let's say, terms like hackathon or clinics. I mean, these are things that will be announced earlier on, in fact, next week's session. And TRACD also has a task to help coordinate some of that effort, and which will then lead to interim presentations at the symposium and hopefully starts branching off into efforts that could continue after the Ontology Summit. So moving over to slide number 3, how are we going to make it happen? Essentially, we need support from the summit community, namely everyone here and everyone on the Ontology Summit mailing list. We need the other track, especially their track co-champions, and the entire community to, of course, help us collect and enumerate what software and tools are out there. We need their help in showcasing some exemplary software environments and tools, like what some of our speakers will be talking about. And then we also want to collaborate with user communities that have real needs to evaluate ontology so that we can have real life use cases to ground our work upon. Not being addressed today, but again, in the later activity that will be sort of broadly put under the roof of the hackathon and clinics would be those efforts of bringing together software developers, tool makers, and user communities. So stay tuned for those. Going on to the next slide, slide number four. For this track, two virtual panel sessions are planned. The first one is today's. We don't have fancy titles for them. We'll just call it Software Environments for Evaluating Ontology 1. That's today. And two, that is session 10 of the summit, scheduled for March 21st. So mark your calendars, especially if you are interested in the software and implementation aspect of things. Going on to slide number five, that's today's briefings that we'll be going through. Dr. Michael Denny of MITRE will start the panelist briefings first off by giving a talk on ontology quality and fitness, a survey of software support. Then Professor Michael Grinninger of University of Toronto would present his talk on ontology evaluation workflow in Colore, the Common Logic Ontology Repository. This is slight swap in presentation order. Ms. Jean Holm actually will follow Michael's talk with her presentation on evaluating U.S. open data for discovery, interoperability, and innovation. Then we will go on to Mr. Gavin Matthews' talk on assuring broad quality in large-scale ontologies. After all the talks, we will have an open question and answer and discussion segment among all the panelists and the participants. This is usually a very interesting segment of a session. So stay there, and you need to be on the chat board to fully leverage that opportunity. So if you're on the call now and you're not yet on the chat board, please get in there. The instructions are at the top of the session page. Moving, so this would be the last slide. Maybe let me ask Michael, if he has anything, Michael Chim, Michael Denny, if he has anything else to add, and take the opportunity to invite him to take over, since his talk follows from here.
Thank you, Peter. I have nothing further to add to what you've already said, so I think I'll move quickly on to my presentation. We have three very interesting talks coming up after mine, and so I'm going to move through this very quickly. This is really just a midpoint report on what our plans are for developing and implementing a survey, at least within the Ontolog community, to assess the software resources that exist that can help Ontology users and Ontology developers ensure the quality and fitness of their products. So if we look at page two, and I'm a little coming a little late to the party, so I think some things may have been in place already in terms of the expectations for this survey. And I began by looking at what evaluation factors and dimensions had been identified by the tracks A through C, and started compiling those, and folks were very helpful, and there were already some compilations of factors as part of our Ontology Summit output. But at this stage, it really seemed that what I was compiling were very general concepts in terms of the reliability and fitness capabilities of ontologies and their quality. So, I mean, those things were like elegance and parsimony and things somewhat general and not well developed at this point, at least in terms of the output from the tract. So when I started putting this together, I realized that it was going to be difficult for software providers to respond in meaningful ways to try to operationalize what we were presenting in this first assembly of quality factors, and that it was either going to lead to very sort of undirected, unspecified responses, or you know, or theses on the capabilities of software, and not very distinct and discrete identifications of particular capabilities. So, I took the list that I had compiled and tried to just brainstorm some of the software capabilities that might address these kinds of quality factors. So the list of capabilities that we'll look at briefly are just that, are intended to be a kind of seeding of candidate capabilities that software tools and software environments might display and offer to their users that do address these specific elements of software quality. If we move on to slide 3, then this also meant that we're only looking at capabilities that address the quality factors that are amenable to the assessment or control of that ontology quality factor by software, and not strictly by humans. So there are dimensions like cost of development or clarity of term definitions that may be poorly, if at all, handled by software and are really the realm of human determination. So those were not included in the list of candidate capabilities. So this operationalization of quality factors into software capabilities really comes from and sort of states the perspective of the ontology user or the ontology builder. I'm on slide 4 now. And it's intended to cover software that is both intended to be an assessment tool of ontology quality and also general ontology development tools or environments. Because quality can be a product post hoc, as in an assessment tool, but it's often also the product of the development process, the whole life cycle, really, of an ontology. Also, this compilation of capabilities ignored some of the distinctions that have been made in the tracks to date, such as intrinsic versus extrinsic factors and implicit versus explicit factors, because it wasn't clear, at least not clear to me, exactly how the role of software could be separated in that regard. So those are still there in the tracks, but in terms of organizing the capabilities that I compiled, it seemed like really the life cycle model was the best approach. So I did create a sequence of general phases for ontology development that we could put various capabilities into. So these buckets were starting at more or less the beginning of the cycle, the exploration phase, management phase, design phase, build phase, validation phase, integration and use phase, and finally maintenance phase. I'm not trying to suggest a particular development methodology or anything here. This was just a convenient way to break the life cycle down into some discrete steps. So if we move on to slide 6, overall, this attempt to see the set of capabilities for software was intended to make it easier for respondents, software providers, to provide us some useful feedback in terms of the distinct capabilities that their software offers that would contribute to ontology quality. Initially, I thought that this would be a kind of checklist that they could check off, as well as a box maybe to the right of it or something that would allow them to explain how that particular software capability is implemented. But because it ended up, at least the seeding of candidate capabilities, ended up being a list of almost 100 items, I was a little, even though they are organized and some providers may only focus on a particular stage of ontology development, which would certainly narrow the potential list. Still, I was concerned about making this palatable to respondents. So one possibility we can consider is to treat it strictly as a checklist and not try to elicit information on how the software actually does it. And maybe we'll leave that as just an optional field within the survey, which is yet to be structured, at least give those people, those respondents, an opportunity to say what they want about that capability. One thing, though, is that it is just a seeding capability. So the survey needs to make provision for them to add additional capabilities to the checklist, essentially, that aren't covered by this list at this stage. So if we move on to 7, basically the respondents will be asked to just go through the list, check off what's applicable to their particular software and adding other distinct capabilities that aren't covered. Slide 8 through the remainder of the slides then is essentially just a listing of the software capabilities. By and large, I tried to make sure that there was reasonable coverage of the particular dimensions and factors that had been suggested or mentioned during the track proceedings. But the explicit mapping between a named quality factor and the software capabilities is not here. There's a certain amount of faith maybe required. Again, I'm also open, before this becomes a survey that's distributed, I'm completely open to suggestions from the track members and any other summit participants as what additional capabilities should be included or what revisions of capability statements might be appropriate. So please bear that in mind. So the first phase, the exploration phase, which would entail potential users of Ontology trying to figure out what it is they need, what Ontology resources are out there, what particular domain ontologies might already be there, and the like. All those things that might, that could precede actually engaging in a project to develop Ontology. So in that phase, we've got capabilities like helping the user define specific domain coverages, or comparing the domain coverages between different ontologies, or more specifically, characterizing the breadth or the depth and detail of the domain coverage. I mean, there are also considerations up front like, and I don't know that I mentioned I'm on slide 8, but of, you know, including aspects of licensing or training or software environment requirements for a particular ontology. Then there are things that might be more specific that would characterize extant ontologies, like the complexity of the concepts that are included in terms in regards to their definitions, the number of different concepts and relations, and the ratio of concepts to relations to instances, the depth of subclassing, aspects like that that might guide a user in their selection of ontologies. Also, there are things like an assessment of the inferencing power of. I don't know whether there are metrics out there that actually express something like that, but it's certainly a possibility. And then there are other things like the reputation of the ontology or the ontology source, its popularity, or systematic accounting of feedback on the ontology. So that's the gist of the software capabilities. As we move to 9, I'm not going to run through all of those. They're here for your more casual reading. But on 9, we have the management phase capabilities, such as organizing and tracking lifecycle requirements, or picking being guided by a particular quality assurance methodology, and the like. As I said, I'm just gonna skip through the remainder of these questions or these capabilities very quickly. On slide 10, we have a design phase. Capabilities include guiding the formulation of requirements for an ontology, and that might include scoping of the domain, determining the data information requirements and interface requirements, determining the semantic and reasoning requirements of the ontology as it is to be applied, choosing the metaphysical methodology that one wants to adopt for that ontology or reflected that ontology, if one wants to. And there's been an interesting discussion just recently, I think, on Ontolog about choosing top ontologies or not, and choosing core ontologies. But all of those things could be factors that could gain guidance from software environments and implementations. Other things like being able to adjust query and inference performance, for example, against, say, compute time, could be a feature that would be facilitated by software during the design phase. we move on to slide 11. This is the build phase, and the build phase I actually broke down into three sort of sub phases. It's the general phase for build, the concepts phase, and the relations phase during build. Those aren't really phases, concepts and relations. I'm just saying, though, that there are enough capabilities associated with constructing and managing the concepts of your ontology and sort of a similar set supporting more of the development and maintenance of relations within your ontology. So I think I've been talking for 15 minutes or more now, so I'm going to skip over then the general phase, the concept phase, and the relations phase of the build parts of the build phase. On slide 14, we have the validation phase. So things like assessing query performance would be something that would happen in validation phase that could be supported by software, such as perhaps determining query precision and recall metrics. Validating instance data that's conforming to the ontology could be one of the capabilities, so that the assessment of the adequacy and goodness of resulting instance data could be determined, at least in part, by software capabilities. Slide 15 is the integration and use phase, and slide 16 is the maintenance phase, which concludes the breakdown of capabilities by phase. So on the ending slide, I'll just say, and then turn this back to Peter, that if there are suggestions about the survey content coming out of this session or subsequent to that, we're probably open until the 22nd of February to incorporate suggestions. And then it will be published to the Ontolog community, the survey. I'm not sure what format will take yet. Perhaps just, you know, even a wiki page might make it easy for people to add new capabilities and check off what applies to them. Not sure. And then once it gets published, I would anticipate that 2 weeks subsequent to that, we could start compiling the submissions unless it's just a living page that requires no summary by us. And that's at that point I'll turn it over to Peter.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for framing the issues for us, and for those of us who have been around a while, as most of you know, that Mike Denny was the original author of the classic ontology editor, ontology building, a survey of editing tools back in 2002, which was updated in 2004 with the with his paper Ontology Tools Survey Revisited. And a table that gets published and referenced for innumerable number of times by this field. So thank you, Denny. And so next up is the talk to be given by Professor Michael Gruninger from University of Toronto. Michael will be talking about ontology evaluation workflow in their Colore, Common Logic Ontology Repository. So, Michael?
Thank you. Thank you, Peter.
Yes, please bring up slide number that is marked 2 Gruninger.
And that, I have about 15 minutes?
Yes, 20.
Okay, thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. So let's move to slide 2. Because the context of my talk today is, as Peter said, with the Common Logic Ontology Repository, or CALORE. And this is a project where we are building an open repository of first-order ontologies, and it was actually designed with the intent that it would provide a testbed for ontology evaluation and integration techniques. We currently have over 1,000 different ontologies. And CALORE is also a participant in the Open Ontology Repository Initiative. You see the URL there, and you can take a look. That address will take you to a Google code site where you can browse through all the different ontologies that we currently have. The focus today, though, will be looking at ontology evaluation, but from the context of, from the perspective of the question of, like, what happens when an ontology is uploaded into the repository? Now, some of our techniques, our code is still rather ad hoc. It's kind of pieces of code. We don't have a really good, tightly integrated environment. I believe that the next session, Chael Mosakowski and Oscar Kutz will be presenting some of the work they're doing with HETS, more integrated environment, because their work has also been being used to analyze and evaluate ontologies within CALORE, among other things. So we'll look forward to their presentation at the next Track B session. If we go to slide 3, there are 5 main aspects of ontology evaluation that I want to talk about today. And in the context of this year's summit that was a track organization, I think these probably lie a little closer to what we're calling intrinsic evaluation. So looking at consistency of an ontology and the different theorems you can prove from that, relationships and comparisons to other ontologies, the verification of ontologies, as we heard from a presentation by Megan Katsumi a few weeks ago, looking at the modularization of ontologies, and then finally a few comments on how ontologies actually get reused. So if we go to slide 4, consistency. I mean, this is just kind of the simplest sort of thing. We actually use Prover 9 MACE 4 combination tool, but you know, people can use anything. But what we do is we have some code that translates common logic into Prover 9 syntax, and then we kind of extend a particular theory with non-empty extensions of all the relations, and then try to construct a non-trivial model. And then all the models are stored in the consistency subdirectories of the repository. So you see a URL there at the bottom. This is specifically dealing with a set of ontologies called combined time, which were taken from Pat Hayes' catalog on temporal theories, which we've analyzed in a few papers. So if you go to that URL, you will find the whole directory of all the different theories in this particular area of combined time, the input file, the .in file, as well as a .model file, which actually shows the model. Now, in these cases, we can only construct finite models. If a theory has infinite models, then we have to use some other more some manual techniques in addition to the automated techniques. On slide 5, we look at the question, well, what are the logical consequences in ontology? So very often people have this question, well, you know, what can I do with this ontology? You give me an ontology, what am I supposed to do with it? Now, one of the fundamental approaches of our ontology design methodology, again, as Megan Katsumi discussed a few weeks ago, is this idea of competency questions. Right, that very often we have different motivating scenarios that are driving the development of an ontology, and a set of queries will arise, and these queries place demands on the underlying ontology. And in fact, we consider these queries to be requirements for the ontology, that you treat these competency questions as actual queries, and you add enough axioms until you can actually entail these particular queries. And again, there's an example there where there's a particular, one of the specific time ontologies is called endpoints, again, taken out of the catalog of temporal theories. And in this particular directory here, there's a few, what we're calling lemmas, different sentences that you can actually derive from this particular ontology called endpoints, which combines time intervals and time points. And again, this kind of just serves as a way of saying, well, is this, you know, which ontologies in a particular, say, part of the repository are strong enough, have enough axioms so that you can actually prove these sorts of, well, we call them lemmas here because we actually reuse them in other places. But the idea being characterizing ontology by its logical consequences. And just as we do with the consistency, the models that show that a particular ontology is consistent, we also store all of the input files and all the proofs also online. So people can browse the proofs, people can download the file and run it on their theorem prover, see if their theorem prover maybe finds it more quickly. Now, if you go to slide six, the slides we just looked at, we're kind of looking at a particular ontology. Is this particular ontology consistent? Does this particular ontology entail particular kinds of theorems you might want to prove? But really, when we're talking about a repository, we're really focusing in on how are all the different ontologies related to each other. And this plays a really big role. I mean, first of all, you know, when we're looking at ontology evaluation, it's not just, oh, is this, kind of a good ontology? Is it a bad ontology? I mean, sometimes you just want to be able to know, well, I have a bunch of different time ontologies. How am I supposed to compare them? Are these apples and oranges? How am I supposed to be able to say, you know, which ontologies can even compare? And in particular, there's, you know, often two main questions when it comes to comparison, which is, first of all, well, do these ontologies, you know, make the same commitments? You know, maybe they really are deep down kind of looking at the same thing, they just happen to be writing different kinds of axioms for them. Or another one would be, well, you know, maybe these two ontologies actually, well, they're definitely not equivalent, but they might even be mutually inconsistent. They may actually make conflicting assumptions. So you want to know, well, what are the differences between these ontologies? What are what, and then the next bullet, their shareability. Well, what, if you have two ontologies that are mutually inconsistent, they make different choices in some way ontologically, what do they have in common? Right. So what are the sub-theories that you have in common between two ontologies? So these two issues of ontology comparison and shareability really drove the development of Colore. So if you look on slide seven, we kind of look at these what are called metalogical relationships in Colore, again, from two different perspectives. I mean, one is, do the theories have the same signature? In other words, do the theories have the same sets of classes and relations that they are axiomatizing? Or do they have different signatures? In other words, does one ontology have a different set of relations than the other one does? Now, if they have the same, so then there are different kinds of extension here, depending on whether they have the same signature or different ones. So on slide eight, we see some logical definitions. These are for theories that have the same signature. That's what sigma is kind of representing there. And so we kind of make a distinction between what are called non-conservative extensions and extensions. So one ontology extends another one if T1, T2 is an extension of T1. If whatever you can prove from T1, you can also prove from T2. Now, this extension is non-conservative if you're able to prove new theorems that are in the signature of T1. But it's conservative if you can always, you know, it's an extension because you can prove some new sentences. But if all the sentences that are in the old signature are also provable in the new one, then we call that a conservative extension. And this plays a big role in ontology modularity. Essentially, if you look at the community and within ontologies that focuses on modularity, essentially a module is a sub-theory of an ontology that's conservatively extended by the entire ontology. Now, how does this play a role? So if we go to slide nine, we actually define this concept of a hierarchy, which is a set of ontologies that all have the same signature. So there's a really, you know, deep sense in which all of these ontologies are kind of all addressing the same set of concepts. So all the different ontologies have the same signature. For example, say with time, the one time theory we're going to be using as an example, you know, they all talk about time intervals, time points. Each time interval has a begin of time point, an end of time point, and there's an ordering over the time points, etc. And so a hierarchy is then the set of theories. They all have the same signature, and it's a partial ordering, and we order it by non-conservative extension. And so if you see on slide 10, this is the kind of combined time ontologies. The dashed lines represent non-conservative extension, and the solid lines indicate conservative extension. And so kind of at the top there, you can see the theory of endpoints, the theory of vector continuum, and these were coming out of the catalog of temporal theories. But then all these other ones kind of arose out of trying to compare those two. Now you can kind of notice, first of all, at the very bottom there, there's a theory called finite MVC end. This is what's called a root theory. So it's kind of the weakest theory of all the different theories in the repository. It's essentially kind of the weakest theory that is shared by all of the different theories in the repository, in this particular hierarchy. Now just above that, you'll see, there's a set of five, different theories. You know, finite moment, finite backwards, etc. We call these the trunk theories. And these essentially represent the kind of the fundamental ontological commitments of the particular hierarchy. And all the other theories are basically just combinations of these particular trunk theories. Then the other thing is, take a look at endpoints and vector continuum. They kind of are both extensions of this theory called SIMVC end. And this is the notion of a similarity. I'm not going to get into the formal definitions of similarity. There's a reference to a paper at the end of the talk. But this SIMVC end is the idea that this is kind of the strongest theory that is shared between endpoints and vector continuum. So this is getting at this idea of shareability. And so when I was talking about kind of the workflow of, you know, what do you do when you add a theory into the repository, well, what I'll be talking about near the end is, when you add a new theory in, what you want to be able to do is not only just add it into the repository, but see how is it related to the other theories in the particular hierarchy. What theories form the similarities between the new one and the existing ones? And, you know, how do we fit it into its place in the hierarchy? And essentially, every one of these dashed lines here is a set of theorem-proving tasks. And so what we do is we take the one theory for every axiom in the other theory, we generate a whole set of files automatically, and then each of those files gets sent to the theorem prover to kind of verify, in fact, that, say, endpoints really is stronger than this theory, SIMVC end. So it really is a non-conservative extension of SIMVC end. If we move to slide 11, So that's the notion of a hierarchy. Again, all these theories kind of are within the same kind of domain. But there's also more general ideas where sometimes the ontologies really do have, you know, different signatures, different relations. But you want to really understand how are they related to each other. And in this case, we specify mappings between the different theories in the repository. And so there are three basic relationships here. Interpretability is where there's a mapping between the theories that preserves the theorems. A faithful interpretation is a mapping that not only preserves theorems, but also preserves models. And then definable equivalence is faithful interpretation in both directions. And so these mappings are actually also axiomatized as within the repository, and I'll get that on the next slide as well. So in slide 12, in general, you're not just showing, say, that two ontologies are equivalent to each other. That does happen in some cases. But actually, a much stronger approach is when we can show that what we say is a theory is actually reducible to a set of other theories. So in the sense of you can take small ontologies and combine them together to make larger ontologies. And we want to understand, you know, how can these pieces be fit together? And so we say a particular theory, T, is reducible to another set of theories, T1 through TN, if first of all, T faithfully interprets each of these smaller theories, the T sub I's. And that, again, is an entailment property. So delta sub I is the set of mappings we call translation definitions. So it's essentially, so delta sub I would contain definitions of all the relations and classes in the signature of T sub I using the language of theory T. And so again, this is a theorem-proving task that we automatically generate and test. And then the other direction, we can take the union of all those different theories and together that union faithfully interprets T. So we can have this other set of translation definitions pi and T1 through TN together with pi, we can actually derive all of the axioms of T. So if you can do these two theorem-proving tasks, then we can show that there's a sense of which T is really kind of equivalent to some of these other existing theories. And so the idea is that when you add a new theory to Calore, we want to search around and find whether or not this new theory that's being added, if there's no kind of existing hierarchy that it belongs to, is it really equivalent to these other existing theories within the repository? And again, there's an example down to the bottom here, a URI, where we show how the endpoints theory that we had looked at our, you know, the hierarchy a few slides ago, can actually interpret a class of mathematical theories called strict graphical. And that's kind of one of the, that's actually a kind of an instance of point one here on this slide, where endpoints is T, strict graphical is one of the T sub I. And you can find in that directory, you can find the different translation definitions. So on slide 13, I can't remember why I put this slide here. A little too technical, but regardless, this actually, oh yeah, sorry, I remember now. So this actually comes up because one of the other bullets that I had that I wanted to address today was verification. And this is something that Megan Katsumi addressed. And there's a really close relationship between this idea of reducibility of theories and the amalgamation of models. So you can take the models of all these different subtheories and combine them together to make a model of the ontology that you're considering. And so on slide 14, this is how we actually do this ontology verification that Megan talked about, that we characterize the models of a new ontology up to isomorphism or maybe elementary equivalence. And we determine whether or not these models are really equivalent to the intended models we had of the ontology we wanted to start with. And so we do this, we use reducibility to show that, in fact, the intended models are kind of an amalgamation of the models of the other theories that are already in the repository. So this is really how we kind of do this description of the intended models. We define them implicitly as the amalgamation of the models of existing ontologies in the repository. So on slide 15, we can also use this notion of reduction to decompose an ontology into smaller modules, because it turns out that the theories that are in the reduction of an ontology are actually definably equivalent to modules in the kind of the classical sense, that sub-theories of T, which are conservatively extended by T. And so the reduction implicitly gives us a modular decomposition of a particular ontology. So a new ontology comes in, we can apply these ideas and actually come up with a modularization of it. So on slide 16, there are kind of the three fundamental procedures that we have to do this. And there's a reference at the end of the paper, at the end of this talk, where we have the paper that is discussed in. So the first procedure is called find theory. And what this does is you add a new theory to the repository, and it finds a set of theories in the repository which are interpretable by T. Then the decomp procedure does that decomposition. So it looks for all of these different kinds of theories and then tries to search through and finds different combinations and tries to prove all those. Now, again, these are called procedures because all of these things are using first-order deduction. And first-order logic is not decidable, and so these aren't algorithms, these are procedures, but it's kind of like we're looking at semi-automated techniques here. So the procedure automatically searches through the repository to find candidate theories, and then that's sent to a theorem prover to actually do the theorem proving. If the theorem prover has some trouble, well, then the user comes in to try to help it out. And then finally, there's an update hierarchy procedure that, given a new theory, inserts it into a particular hierarchy and then guarantees that all the similarities and differences with all the other theories in the hierarchy are also identified. And so then on slide 17, this is addressing this idea, another idea of ontology evaluation, which is, why are we doing the evaluation? And well, also often has to do with the idea of reusing ontologies, right? Which of the ontologies in the repository do I really need? And so this actually builds off some work that Ali Hashemi did when he did his master's in our lab, where you can adapt the procedures that we looked at to actually search for the weakest theories in a hierarchy that really do entail a particular set of competency questions. We can also, and this was kind of the original, Ali's original work, we can search, you can find an ontology by providing it with a set of models. You can represent the models in a certain way that formalize your intuitions about concepts and relations in your intended semantics. And we can use these procedures in the previous slide to actually find the theories that best match up with your intended models. And so these are two different ways of answering this question, well, which one of these do I really need? So on slide 18, we have some references. The last bullet there, proof support for common logic, is a paper with Till and Oliver and Mihai Codescu and Christoph Lange, which kind of addresses some of these earlier points by using the Hetz environment to provide a much more integrated environment. And like I said earlier, we'll be hearing more about this, I think, in the next Track D session. So on slide 19, just a summary here. Hopefully I kind of communicated some of the basic ideas of how we're using a repository to support ontology evaluation. Again, these are primarily intrinsic aspects of consistency checking, entailment, interpretation, verification of modularity. But the other key idea here is how automated theorem provers play such a critical role. And this is the final slide. I'd just like to thank all the members of the Semantic Technologies Lab who have contributed to this work, Ali Hashemi, Torsten Hamann, Darren Ong, Adelaide Ostavde, Megan Katsumi, and Carmen Chui. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Great presentation. So next up is Ms. Jean Holm from data.gov, as well as NASA JPL. So Jean is going to give her talk on evaluating U.S. open data for discovery, interoperability, and innovation. If you notice, we are not limiting software environments to just tools, but Jean's presentation will touch upon real-life applications and environments where ontologies are needed, and she would be telling us more. Jean? If people would bring up the slide deck labeled 3 Holm, yeah, let's make sure we can hear Jean. Jean cannot hear you yet.
Yep. Can you hear me, Peter?
Yes.
Great.
Go ahead.
So thanks so much for inviting me to come and talk to the Ontology Group today. And I just want to put some context around this discussion, as you just did, Peter, which is that we have been operating data.gov, which is the U.S. Open Data Federal Repository of Data, with not a very rigorous ontology in the background. So you'll see that this is actually an open invitation to the members of Ontolog to help us fix this huge gap in our infrastructure. To just as I walk through what data.gov is and how we try to get people access and are working on interoperability and open source, that it's really an invitation, which, Peter, I'm hoping we're going to be able to realize at the summit in May, to be able to try to put a project around this. So data.gov on the second slide is really the U.S. government open data accessibility points. It's not really the repository itself. While we provide access to over 400,000 data sets from across the U.S. government and across the nation, those contributions actually come from and are often hosted by the 180 different agencies in the U.S. federal government that are providing that data. Peter, I think we're on slide 2.
Yes, we're on slide 2 now. So you might just move ahead.
All right,
maybe
sorry.
I'm loading too slowly.
Maybe it's just slow on mine.
Yeah, maybe you just run it from your desktop, but remember to announce the events.
Okay. And In addition to federal data, we also provide access to city, state, and county data from across the U.S. So that adds another 14 or so thousand data sets that come from cities small and large and states across the country. We also link to data from other countries and other international organizations like the UN, the World Bank, OECD. And the intent here is to provide a single access point for people to be able to find that data without having to go to many, many, many different repositories. On the third slide, the next slide, really talks about the impetus behind data.gov as we move into the future is the U.S. digital strategy. So in this case, that digital strategy put out by the U.S. Chief Information Officer, Stephen Van Roekel, really is looking at how we can get smarter about the way that we make information machine readable, that we manage our devices and applications, and that we secure data for provenance and accuracy, and really to try to unlock that power of government data. So we've seen this happen over and over again, where companies come, they find information from the government, and they take that data and are able to use to create either new companies, new jobs, new ventures, everything from health to energy to education. We have a lot of things going on right now with advanced manufacturing and research that's coming out of the government and being put into manufacturers across the country. So we're really focused on trying to get that up and out of the government and into the hands of people who can make sense of it and do something with it. And as you can sense, the big issue for that becomes discoverability and the ability for people to navigate and find that information. So the next slide tells us that we're really focused on these five things, which is gathering the data, connecting communities, providing this infrastructure, encouraging our technology developers across the country, and then continuously moving through this life cycle so that we always gather more data, connect to more people, and try to get it out to citizens in ways that's going to make sense to them. One of the things we've done to try to do something in a sort of non-technology way is on the next slide, which is our new alpha.data.gov. So this just came up a week and a half ago. And alpha are the stories around open data. So this is a sort of conversational space where you can look at something that's happening in energy or finance or commerce or health and say, wow, there's new capabilities called iTriage, which reaches 7 million people and helps them get faster access to medical care in an emergency. What's the story behind that, and what data is the government offering, or what web services or what capabilities is the government offering that's helping to power that business? So I invite you to just go there. It's kind of a fun read and very much like a magazine style. And the next slide tells us that we're really looking at the idea of building these communities. So when we think about a community, even like Unsquad, there's a unifying idea behind what brings all of us together to talk about ontologies and taxonomies and the vocabularies behind them and how that helps us to better affect change in the groups that we're working with or to better make a difference in trying to understand and do research in our areas. So the same concept is what we do on data.gov with our communities, which vary quite a bit because they're based on national and citizen priorities that come up. So, again, things from manufacturing to business, ethics, city, safety, energy, all of these are different communities on data.gov. And the context for sort of an ontology behind these is that what we're really trying to do is revamp the entire infrastructure of data.gov. We're moving to a much better catalog capability I'll talk in a moment, that get the opportunity to actually go from our rather ad hoc taxonomy for navigation to a much, much more robust ontology that will help to power the linked data and semantic web capabilities that we're working on bringing up. The next couple of slides just walk you through the idea of one of our communities. This one's our energy community. And, again, trying to set the context and the usability for how an ontology might power this. I just thought that would be a useful thing for people to hear. So in our energy community, our goal here is, from leaders of this space, is to connect innovators, industry, academia, and government to drive innovation across energy sectors across the United States. This means that we work with everything from looking at public safety issues around fracking and shale gas extraction to discussing alternative energy sources like solar, to looking at policy decisions that have been made and people's feedback on that, to one of our initiatives is called the Green Button, which is actually not using government data but using government capability to help local energy companies make information available to consumers to make better decisions and to buy better and more affordable energy. So the next slide shows you how one of the ways in which we try to connect those people and engage, we work with a sister site called challenge.gov that puts up money from agencies that are specifically looking at areas where they're trying to find solutions to really wicked problems. They may be small problems or large problems, problems that maybe the government is stymied or unable to solve, or just, you know, we're really looking for new out-of-the-box ideas. So these come up on challenge.gov, and they're often supported by or informed by data that we provide from data.gov. Or in some cases, there's a recent challenge out from HHS related to metadata standards that are really going to be part and parcel of a shared infrastructure capability as we evolve trying to work more closely across government agencies. So the next slide shows you that these challenges end up with solution spaces. Sometimes they're winners, sometimes they're suggestions that come in and help to let us see how people are using that government data, finding that government data, and being able to put it in the hands of citizens. And the next slide just shows you more about this Green Button initiative. So what this means is you can go, so right now we have 21 million American households that can go to their local energy provider, so not a government space, but like I'm here in California where Peter is. So I can go to my local utility site where I pay my bill and find my energy usage, and there's a green button there for me. And I can click the green button and download my historical energy use data and run it against certain applications that have been developed in response to challenge.gov and other places and find out a better way for me to manage my energy consumption so I can save money, so I can apply for rebates, maybe it's time to put in solar panels on my roof. So this helps me be able to make better decisions and be able to understand how I can save money and better manage my resources. Now, the trick here is that it's one thing to be able to get that into the hands of like a utility company that's going to have immediate access and information for people, or getting it onto a smartphone app that might be able to let people scan in store certain items to see if there's been a recall for a safety issue on a crib they're looking at buying for a new child, for example. But the very first step in making these kinds of things happen is really trying to be able to get people access to that data. And with 400,000 data sets soon to be growing at an exponential level as we federate more and more catalogs, the ontology and taxonomy behind data.gov is a critical stumbling point, potentially, in getting people access to that information. So the next couple of slides, I'm just going to kind of walk past so I don't take up too much time here. One just shows you that we do have ways for people to find data today. It's not completely nonsense, but people can find it through a set of categories that we currently have deployed, but they're pretty generic categories. They're not necessarily government-focused. But you can find it certainly through a keyword search. You can look at tag clouds. You can look at categories. You can filter it by year or agency publication. There's lots of ways to find the data, but it's not as structured as we would like it to be. And the next slide shows you that there's lots of ways to visualize that data, too, right on the site. So you can do maps on the site. You can do graphical visualizations with one or two clicks without having to, like, even download the data onto your desktop. You can just do it on the site and share that back to the community so people can see that when you mash up two data sets, that it makes an interesting analytic that maybe helps to inform a decision that you're going to make. The next slide lets us look at the fact that we are at a very opportunistic moment here on data.gov that I wanted to be able to reach out to the Ontolog group for. So we have a variety of groups we've worked with. We work closely with W3C and Jim Hemler and his group up at RPI. But we want to kind of extend that to look at this whole area of government ontologies. And there are many that have been published. And what we're trying to do is really understand how to manage and put those together in a way that can be expressed for two reasons. One, for the U.S. government through data.gov. And the second is through a new project that we're working with governments around the world. So the next slide talks a little bit about this. It comes, our project is called the Open Government Platform, OGPL, and it comes out of the U.S. Government National Action Plan. So it was a direct request from President Obama that we coordinate with first the government of India as our primary partner to open source a capability to allow open data sites to come up without them having to sort of like procure actual software somewhere else. So we combined things we'd learned on data.gov with things that the India government had learned on their national portal, and we have released this code as open source on GitHub. So the next slide just kind of explains a little bit of that and a couple of the links. I have the wrong date here. The alpha code has already been released, and the beta code will be released this month. And what we have are two different, we have a couple of different forks on GitHub. So one of those forks is a clean Drupal implementation. So if a country or a group wants to start an open data site or an open government site, that the whole ability to publish that data, manage that data, and display that data, make it accessible and searchable, is available within this collection of Drupal modules and capabilities that are put together on the OGPL site. There's another fork that is in alpha that is working with CCAN, which is a UK-based product, and provides an open source capability for the back-end catalog, which allows people to be able to put together much more robust catalogs that are interoperable and it can be federated more easily. And then there's a third fork that we're working on with a few other governments that may provide some additional tools for citizen engagement and social media and that sort of thing. But within this environment, there's a big need for how are we going to suggest to governments, what kind of ontology do we suggest to governments for people to be able to organize that information in a way that makes it much easier to create linked data. So the slide that Peter has up now really looks at where we are today with data.gov, and we are, you know, we have a robust infrastructure, but we are in the midst of rolling out this new capability with CCAN. So we have keyword and faceted filtering. We have, you know, over 6 billion triples in our RDF triple store. And we have the beginnings of vocabularies, and some vocabularies expressed on our vocab.data.gov site. And George Thomas and the gang over at HHS have been great about putting up URIs for all health data, and we will have persistent URIs for all government data as it comes out through data.gov in our next deployment at the end of March. So as we move forward, you'll notice there's this piece where we have not done the idea of really how to move and manage and aggregate or promote or select ontologies that have been developed elsewhere to provide, really at the next slide, that 5-star linked data that Tim Berners-Lee would like us to be able to move to. So while we have a lot of data at, you know, 1 and 2 stars and maybe even 3 stars, trying to get to 4 and 5 stars becomes a much more difficult thing if we don't actually have a structured way of expressing the connection between the data. And an ontology is certainly, we have metadata, which is fine, but having an ontology certainly gives us a much, much more robust way of looking at that. So we have been working with others. The next slide just references some of the work we're doing with schema.org, IEEE, ISO, AGU, and OASIS. We've tried a few crowdsourced folksonomies and crowdsourcing data. We've done a lot of that with USAID and some other things around food security. We're going to be doing more of that. And then Jim Handler and his team out at RPI have been great in helping us sort of move forward. And then on the next slide, it's really looking at WQC and some of the leadership there with Phil Archer and others who've been working on some of the early week data work and Bernadette Highland and George Thomas. And now Heavy Beeman, I think, is helping to lead that group. And then the government of India and CCAN as well, which is part of the Open Knowledge Foundation. So the challenge out to all of you guys is on the next slide, which is that we are looking for suggestions and ideas. And specifically, I can't think of a better group than the Ontolog group of people who are really who really understand everything from the fundamental research, like the Michael has just been telling us about, to the ability to manage an ontology as it is being evolved, to the ability to deploy that ontology into some operational spaces. And I'm obviously kind of at the far end of the deploying the ontology into operational spaces aspect today. But we're really looking at how between now and that summit in May, we might be able to put together the concept of a project we can work on over the next bit of time, next year or so, to be able to identify and coalesce around some standards or process issues about creating this kind of an ontology. I put my contact information at the bottom if you're interested, both Twitter or email, whichever's easy for you. If you're interested in that, and certainly Peter and I will work together to make this happen as part and parcel of the overall plan for the summit. The next couple slides just kind of wrap it up. The idea here is that we are not limited in any way to federal data, although that is really kind of our focus, but we link to other government data across the country, cities, counties, and states. We have quite a few that are coming up on each of those sites, and more are being added each week, which lets you look quickly across and be able to find, for example, all the hospital data across the states, our transport data across your region without having to figure out whether the city of Boston has a separate site than the county, than the state, than the federal, when you're just looking at transportation vectors across the city of Boston. All four of those actually come into play. And then this is not restricted to the U.S. So the next slide really points to the fact that we have a vastly growing number of countries and regions and provinces and cities across the world that are doing this. We currently have OGPL, that Open Government Platform, running in the U.S., India, Ghana, and we will be seeing it shortly come up in Rwanda and Canada as well. And we have a lot of express interest from many other countries. Which gives us this opportunity to provide an ontology that could be developed through that open source capability to a lot of different countries and be able to affect the idea of international collaboration around data of things like education, human rights, gender equality, climate change, and things that cross national borders or need to be discussed across national borders. So as we move ahead on the next slide, we're really trying to bring that data up and out of the government. And the piece that we're really challenged with here that and we'd love to work with the Ontolog group is to make that data accessible and linked so that people can find it across a rapidly growing number of data sets and a rapidly growing number of international capabilities to be able to really work on those global issues. So, again, my contact information in the presentation is also on the very last slide, which you can connect through Twitter also just directly to data.gov, which I tweet under as well. And I would really love to be able to, you know, have a discussion with you all together or at the summit or individually about your ideas here and how you best think we could move ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Jean. That's really wonderful, and we are excited to have the opportunity to work with you. For those who know Jean, she had a stellar earlier career as Chief Knowledge Architect at NASA, JPL, and with that illustrious results that behind her, she was enlisted to the White House to evangelize data.gov. And I'm glad she and her colleagues are now considering the move from shallow semantics to deep semantics. And we look forward to working with you, Jean. And please mark your calendar on the next Track D session, because we will actually be bringing in people who have a lot of experience deploying linked open data and this new initiative called Linked Open Vocabulary, as well as those who see the path between linked data all the way to formal semantics. I mean, we'll have people like Michelle Dumontier, Kingsley Idahan, and so on among our panelists, besides people as Michael mentioned earlier, people in the more formal side of the spectrum, like Adam Pease and Till Mosukowski, joining us on March 21st. So make sure you can join us then too. Thank you, Jean.
Thanks, Jared.
So next up is a talk to be given by Gavin Matthews. And Gavin has huge experience with his earlier career at Psych, and he is now Vice President of Research for Vertical Search Works that hosts some of the most elaborate semantic search technologies around. And Gavin is going to tell us how he has been using ontologies in his talk entitled Assuring Broad Quality in Large-Scale Ontologies. So, Gavin?
Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. Slides.
Okay, so my name is Gavin Matthews. Here at Vertical Search Works, we have a large-scale ontology. We don't publish it. We don't publish our tools, but we use it in-house as part of our search engine service. So we're not academic researchers. Instead, what I'm going to be talking about is a case study in how we ensure ontology quality in our day-to-day procedures and next slide, please, slide two. What I'm talking about here is all work in progress, proprietary internal tools. So please, to give you any rough edges, I'll be talking about the structure of our ontology, its representation language, the role it plays in our technology, and some of the validation tools we use, both on the ontology and end-to-end. Slide three, please. So Vertical Search Works itself has only been around for a few years, but both the core technology we use and, in fact, some of the members of the development team have been around a lot longer. What we do is fundamentally semantic vertical search, semantic meaning that we identify concepts in documents and queries, and we match those together in our search rather than just using keywords. Vertical means that any given search application we operate is narrowly focused on some particular domain of discourse, like food or weddings, and that informs the interpretation of the query concept. And we also do contextual advertising. From the business perspective, this is our main product, but from the engineering perspective, we treat it as a search problem. The article is a query, and the adverts are a search corpus. And that, you know, we're taking in billions of impressions per month on that side. So slide four, please. As I say, we have a large-scale ontology that's a key part of a web-scale search engine. Our ontology is tailored for our specific task We do try to work with third-party ontologies, but we don't. We often find that they're not suitable for direct import because they don't fit in with exactly what we're trying to do. The use of the ontology is key to all of our software engineering processes and our testing environments. This screenshot you see here is taken from an actual tool that our ontologists use every day for visualizing the ontology. Here you see we're focusing on one of our local American football teams, San Diego Chargers, and you can see there's upwards links and a number of horizontal links. You can see that Alex Spanos, the owner, has a possession link. We know that San Diego Chargers is a NFL team, and they played a role in Super Bowl 29, and they're a member of the AFC West Conference. They're located in Qualcomm Stadium, which in turn is located in San Diego. Lance Alworth is a prominent famous player. And finally, we know that they're homonymous with cell phone chargers, which is the little yellow node up the top. This is associated with a hyperlink concept browser that, again, many people in the company use day-to-day, and we find these together to be essential for detecting ontology defects, especially along long chains of inference. Slide 5, please. Underlying all this, we have a proprietary flat file representation, which is frame and slot. We sometimes translate this in and out of other formats like RDF, but this is what we store in flat files, in source control, in just the same way as we do with any of our source code. You see here on the left the same concept as you saw before the San Diego Chargers. This only shows the outgoing links. The incoming links are, of course, inferred from the corresponding other frames. The visualization on slide 4 only showed the concept-to-concept links. Here you see down the bottom there's also concept-to-string links. You see we've got a couple of expressions that the UF is showing you how we would, the sort of expression we would identify as being associated with concepts in text. And on the right you see another concept I've included, the breakfast waffle. It's interesting here we see it has two parents. We don't restrict our relationships. The BT links there say that it's a breakfast food and a baked food. We have translations for this concept in English, French, and Spanish. The homonymy link here is actually indicating homonymy in French. The word gaufre is used, can mean both waffle and gopher in French. So that's something we have to watch out for. Our ontology is largely subsumption-based. We've got instance of, subtype of, part type of, geographical part of. But we have many horizontal links as well. The broad related to the more specific has theme of, or plays role in, member of, located in. Altogether, our ontology comprises over 500,000 language-independent concepts. We call them synsets, short for synonym sets, inspired by WordNet terminology. It's a general-purpose ontology that we have fleshed out for a number of specific verticals, depending on our business interests. The lexicon includes over 2 million terms or expressions, mostly in English or language independent. The terms we use are heavily annotated with linguistic constraints to control stemming, case folding, diacritic folding, punctuation folding, all the things you need to know to determine whether to match strings in NL text. Slide 6, please. This rather busy diagram shows the ancestor chains of two concepts in our hierarchy that both happen to have the word Madonna on them. The one on the left is the pop singer and actress, and the one on the right is the Virgin Mary. So I include this to show that we, how we handle homonymy and disambiguation in our ontology structure, and also that subsumption reasoning is very important to us. The reasoning we do in our ontology is largely special case. We don't do general purpose reasoning, but there's lots of things we have. We identify each of our synsets, each of our concepts as being in zero or more verticals. The ontology is used as part of our document classification system, and also it ties into our dynamic entity extraction. Slide 7, please. This slide shows the steps we go through when we're using our ontology to disambiguate natural language text. So we're starting with the sentence at the top, Apple and Sun distributed different Java implementations. You imagine that might appear in a web document somewhere. The first thing we do is we extract the natural language text from the HTML. We tokenize, bold, and stem it, and then we look through our ontology, the expressions, and find all the possible candidate concepts. So you see the concept Apple could mean a computer company, a fruit, or it could be a short expression for a particular performer with that name. Sun can be a star, computer company, or the three-letter code for an airport. Java can be copy, programming language, or an island. You see there in the blue we have the possible interpretations. We use a combination of proximity in the document and proximity in the ontology to select the best interpretation. So here you see in the orange we've decided that because computer companies and programming languages are conceptually proximate, then we can infer that by finding these terms close together in the document, we can choose that interpretation. By latching to a particular concept rather than just leaving it at the keyword level, this disambiguation increases our precision. You can search for Apple and bring back documents that are just about the fruit or just about the computer company. And at the same time, by having concepts with multiple expressions on them, we can increase recall. We can bring back documents that don't include the user's search query, literally. We also unroll the ancestor chain, which is what the green box at the bottom is, as another way of increasing recall. So if a document is talking about Apple and Sun, we know that it might be a good document if you search for computer companies. The sort of processing we do, we have to do very fast. We've got a budget of 100 milliseconds per document, so we're very tightly constrained in the level of analysis we can do and the size and complexity of ontology that we can use. Slide 8, please. So this is a screenshot from one of our public search portals. The users type Java, which could mean many things, but because we're narrowing on food context, we assume that they're talking about coffee. On the query side, we do the same sort of tokenization and stemming. We try to match the concept in our ontology, but we also, as a backup, use the corpus itself as a keyword search to help us see how we've interpreted it in documents that are in vertical. We also use the ontology directly to generate drill-down searches in two ways. You see under the search box, we've got narrow, broader, related, and narrower is showing you various particular types of coffee. Under that, you see the word categories. These are document classifications that seem related to an interest in coffee because of links from the ontology. And finally, last but not least, we use the ontology to match up appropriate adverts. You see on the right, far right-hand side of the screen, there are coffee-specific adverts. And this is, those adverts didn't use the word Java, but we've linked it through the ontology and the disambiguation. Slide 9, please. So our actual evaluation cycle for both the ontology and the whole system in which it is embedded, it closely parallels our software development processes. There's four key components that I'm going to talk about in our ontology evaluation. The first is that we have automatic validation. It's a syntax check, and it does some basic inherent checks. Ontologists run this locally when they're when they've made changes and they're about to check in. And as a double check on that, we have the open source cruise control, which is running in source control, and that will let them know within an hour if they forgot to do that. We do the same validation at every step, every time we do an indexing in our nightly builds, our pushes to production. It's part of every cycle. Secondly, we have a black box search quality testing that runs nightly against the our toy development corpus, and is also run every time we do an indexing cycle. We monitor metrics there. I'll talk about more about that in the next slide. Thirdly, we do glass box testing, where we have unit tests that are aimed at both functional coverage and regression testing. This is exactly the same process we use for our to test our code, is we test the semantic interpretation stability and all sorts of features of that. And fourthly, I should mention that that again is performed nightly and with every indexing cycle. And fourthly, most of our ontology revisions are subject to the usual defect tracking processes we use for all our software and our change management processes. So they'll go through a manual desk check by someone, and that in turn feeds back into our unit tests and regression tests. Slide 10, please. So just to drill down onto the black box testing we do, this is an end-to-end evaluation of the architecture as a whole and its search quality, but it's key in understanding how changes to the ontology affect our system. It's based on the TREC methodology, just to spell that out, that's Text Retrieval Conference. We use the TREC eval tool they developed, and we use some of the metrics that they designed. We started out using the Gov corpus, but we moved to using our own internal test corpus that has the appropriate vertical focuses and uses queries that are typical of our customer queries. Some of them we actually draw from logs. We currently have about 11,000 evaluations, what TREC called judgments, and for about 500 queries of what TREC called topics. We'd love to have more. We gather them in a number of ways. At the right of the screen, you can see one of our search UIs, which is running with a Grease Monkey script. It's very simple, but it just adds buttons and color boxes to the search UI that lets anyone just look at our search results and say, or anyone with access to look at our search results and say thumbs up, thumbs down, and enter evaluations very quickly. We also post tasks in Mechanical Turk so that we can have outside contractors contribute to our test corpus. We run these tests repeatedly. It's designed so that we can slice and dice and see, break it down by individual verticals, see how different configurations of the system score relative to each other, and even break it down into the level of individual queries or individual test results, see how they change. In looking at this, we always have to be careful to keep the levels of statistical significance in mind. The data is very low, once you start to drill down, and we have to use the results very carefully. Changes in score are always much more important than absolute values. For example, here you see us tracking three of our verticals, but it's not meaningful to say that one vertical is above another because they are being tested against different test corpora. Slide 11, please. So, in conclusion, we've developed our own in-house tools for browsing and visualizing ontologies and visualizing certain inferences across those ontologies. And we find those to be absolutely essential for our quality assurance of the ontology. We're using a large ontology as a key part of real-world applications, and we're combining a variety of QA techniques, intrinsic and extrinsic, black box, glass box, automated and manual. Slide 12, please. So this last slide just shows some links where you can go and find some of our search portals. You can't see our ontology directly, only its effect on the system as a whole. So that's everything I have to say. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Gavin. This is just wonderful. And brief as it is, we summarily showed the spectrum from engineering, from science to real needs to engineering. And obviously, the parameters, the attributes, the focus are quite different. And hopefully, that sort of informs how we could continue to assemble and frame the discussion as to what we really need and how it could really be done in terms of ontology evaluation. So thank you to all the panelists, and this starts our Q&A and open discussion segment. We have roughly about 20 minutes or so, and as all of you know, you will need to be in the chat room to be recognized. Otherwise, we wouldn't know if you wanted to speak. And since everyone is muted, when you're recognized, please try to test your voice first before going into making your remarks. And now we want everyone who has a remark to make, or if you've already made it in the chat, you might want to sort of elaborate on it some more so that it gets better documented on the voice recording and so on. So please click on the hand button, which is on the lower right of the chat window, and I can see Doug Volksburg's hand already. So please click on that green button so that we can queue everyone up. I will recognize people one at a time. And since we didn't have a chance to allow people to introduce themselves, after you make sure you're heard, briefly mention who you are and where you're coming from. So, Doug. Star 7 to unmute.
Yeah. Hi, this is Doug.
Yes,
can
hear you.
I'm at NIST. Michael Denny suggested various ways of categorizing the breadth, depths of ontologies, user considerations, etc. I was wondering if he had created an ontology of the concepts for doing such characterizations.
So, Michael, you want to? I guess if you're responding, you don't have to put your hand up. If you're at the panel, yeah.
Yes. The answer is no. An ontology has not been developed. I hadn't even thought of developing an ontology that would cover evaluation factors or software capabilities that address evaluation factors. I mean, I think that it's a very interesting notion, especially seeing, I think, some of the lessons learned out of these tracks has been that it's sort of a slippery object to grab hold of, that being ontology quality and fitness. So I think it would be a valuable undertaking, but no, I haven't done anything that way.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Michael, Danny, your hand is up. Do you have a separate?
Oh, no, that was trying to respond. So for future reference, I guess I don't need a hand up to respond.
Right, and for people who don't yet realize it, clicking on that hand button again sort of toggles, lowers your hand. So you can.
Okay, so let me lower my hand.
Okay, yep. Fabian?
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, my question is for Gavin. I'm curious to know what kinds of tests are involved, in particular the black box tests. What kinds of tests do we implement, and what are the kinds of tests you think are particularly useful to improve the quality of the ontology?
I'm sorry, were you asking about our black box tests?
Yes.
So the black box tests I was describing are the TREC methodology. We're using queries, actual search queries, and actual judgments of whether documents are good, bad, very good, preference ranks judgments, and using the TREC methodology to calculate scores of the system as a whole.
So for example, I don't know, if I have a search thing like Thai food, you would put it, and somebody manually evaluates what if your search engine finds results for that, whether these are good or not.
That's right. We have a search like Thai food, and people say yes, no on results, looking at them, assessing them according to a narrative that we developed for Thai food, the same sort of methodology as the TREC conference has been doing for years, but we're developing our own corpus in-house.
Good, thank you.
Okay, actually I have one question for Gavin too. It's Peter Yim here. Given your huge experience with psych, part of the psych ontology go into the type of ontology you're using in the semantic search now, or if not the fully axiomatized ontology, how about maybe the vocabulary or the terms, terminology, maybe as captured in things like, what's his name, Umbel, which is in SCoS and has pretty much all the terminology that are in psych, if I understand correctly. Did those come into play, when you're developing your in-house ontology?
That's an interesting question, Peter. We haven't done any formal import of the psych ontology or Umbel, but what we did instead is we hired a considerable number of former psycho employees over the years, myself included. That way we have inherited a lot of the experience from psych, and we do go back to psych, look at psych from time to time when we have a representational argument.
Very interesting. So again, if you have remark to make or have questions for the panelists, or if the panelists have a question for another panelist, please click on the hand button. So one of the things we wanted to do during this summit, and particularly as described earlier, that TRACD will help facilitate, is to bring together teams that might want to contribute to some hackathon effort. What we mean by that is for groups who might collaborate, or maybe individuals who might take some time, a specific time window, maybe over a weekend, to generate some new code that matches well with the theme or the findings of the discourse so far. That's the hackathon effort. And then there will be like clinics effort, whereby people could take ontology evaluation tools and send ontologies through it, or take software environment requirements and sort of evaluate what the right ontologies would be, I mean, on a clinic's consulting discourse type basis. So I highly encourage all the panelists and participants here to consider that, as we will be having a session next week to frame that discussion. So please make sure you join us too then. I have a hand from Joanne Luciano. Joanne, star 7.
Thank you.
Can you briefly introduce yourself first?
So, hi, my name is Joanne Luciano. I'm a research associate professor at Rensselaer's Tetherless World Constellation. In the same place where Jim Hendler and the data.gov work is taking place, I put some links on there because we've been using a lot of the government data and creating a linked data repository. And I think have the largest one in the linked open data cloud, and have been doing a lot of work with making data more available and building ontologies that enable data to be more accessible to the general public that want to do mashups on their own. But that's not why I raised my hand. But I just wanted to thank Jeannie and let people know that there are some tools available for both accessing the data and visualizing the data, as well as doing data quality metrics. I want to also thank my old Denny for taking over the co-chairing of this track, and for Peter's incredible patience with me, because I really didn't have the bandwidth. But the reason I raised my hand is because in preparation for the hackathon session, and so that I could make an appropriate contribution to this summit, I need some help with some software development. I had a student work for a while on it last year, and a couple of students, but didn't really get very far. And since I don't have funding for them, they're not very reliable. So I'd like to make a request out to the community for anyone who has some interest in taking this sort of framework approach that I have, that puts both intrinsic and extrinsic in context, as well as what can be used for a methodology for development. It's not the details, it's the framework, but I still think it's a valuable contribution that I'd like to have get assessed, you know, properly. So if you have any software resources or want to collaborate or know anyone who might, please send them my way. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. I mean, glad your hand is up. And so, Amanda, I mean, both of you are people I need to thank especially. Joanne was co-champion for TRACD until she decided to focus in making content contribution rather than administrative contribution. I guess that probably means a lot more to us into the Ontology Summit as a whole. And then I also wanted to thank Amanda for her recommendation of Gavin Matthews, whom she had been a colleague with, I believe. And I mean, it's just wonderful. So since Amanda, your hand is up, the mic is yours. Go ahead.
Okay. yes, I, in fact, worked for Davin in two environments we've mentioned. One at Canvera, while that still existed before Vertical Search Works, and at Psyche. I worked under Davin in both places and benefited immensely from his leadership on the evaluation of ontologies and the bringing the QA sensibility into those environments in a really strong way. And my comment briefly, which I also typed into the chat, is that last week when we were discussing the development of ontologies to meet evaluation criteria, we were supposed to be discussing that. We actually got to it very little. We didn't talk very much about how the evaluation could actually guide the development. The evaluation, the very thorough types of testing that Gavin talked about are used were used when I was at Canvera to help guide development. And that... so we might want to talk about that a little bit, or we ask Gavin more about it. But I can say, as having been a developer under that regime of quality, it was immensely beneficial to have that kind of feedback and really kept us on track.
Gavin, you could sort of highlight some of the aspects that Amanda was alluding to just now.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm not sure what the question was there.
So, Amanda, could you sort of reframe? It wasn't a question. I mean, she was making a remark on certain areas that you will probably we will probably benefit a lot with your sharing of experience. So maybe you highlight the specific areas that might be helpful to all of us, Amanda. Again,
I can try. So, you know. My experience developing ontologies with the benefit of the kinds of evaluation that Gavin discussed is that it's a rare pleasure for one thing, because you have immediate feedback as to how you're doing, but Gavin, not having been in the prior sessions, won't sort of have this context, but you know, when we've tried to get on track about the interaction of ontology evaluation and ontology development, many people in the field don't have the experience of developing ontologies with any real evaluation regime in place. So the ways that that evaluation or testing of various types is used to give ontologists feedback, or to, you know, not only expose gaps, but treat them as software bugs and so forth. I think that hearing sort of more about that would be one point of particular value. And the tools that you use to do it, I know, Gavin, you tend to use a combination, I think, of the existing in-house infrastructure for testing, obviously, and more commonly used QA tools like Bugzilla or something like this that people never think of applying to ontologies or to semantic technology systems. So if you could tell us sort of more about how you use that kind of a software environment to enable developers to act like ontology developers, to act like responsible code developers. That, I don't know if I simplified or clarified that or just made it muddier, but that's what I was trying to get at.
Okay, well, that's quite an open-ended question. Let me see if I can hit a few points. So I have trouble explaining this because many of the things we do coming from, so I should explain, I'm not an ontologist, I'm just a programmer. And many of the things that I make ontologists do seem obvious to a programmer. We track bugs in Bugzilla. We have strict source management processes. We branch sources, send them out into production, do testing before it goes live. We review defects that come in and see if we can find out why they came in, how we can catch them upstream or stop them getting in, all the usual process improvement. One thing that I've done with Amanda at Psycor is I've applied formal software inspection techniques to ontology development, where you sit down and with a significant investment of time, find all the defects you can and estimate how many defects are remaining. I didn't include any of that material in this presentation. Is that the sort of thing you wanted, Amanda?
Yes, and under the topic of, you know, of software environments, you know, the if there are things other than Bugzilla maybe that would be familiar to software engineers among our participants, but not at all obvious to the average ontologist or ontology project manager. All of that is, I think, insight that you can provide that that people would benefit from. So maybe you should just let that lead be there, and let's see if anybody else wants to follow up on it or something, ask you anything. But having been in that position of having been an ontologist and then having experienced twice in very different technical environments with very different types of ontologies and applications, the benefits of your sort of bringing this kind of software engineering discipline to the effort, I very much appreciate that it's not obvious and that to people in ontology, and that it's completely doable, and it doesn't have to answer every question to add enormous value from both the management and developer sides. So,
thanks, Amanda. Perhaps I should just touch on a couple of other points that you made me think of. One is information system. I've found it essential to have make it as easy as possible for people to provide documents and share documents and make sure people have access to the latest version of documents so that people aren't sending things back and forth. I found MediaWiki technology or Wiki technology to be a key for that. I see someone mentioned that on the chat. And then one other point is, for me, from the software side, visibility, transparency of the system is crucial. Whenever I see what ontologists do, whenever I sit with an ontologist and work through a task, I always try to see a way that from the software side we could support that better. Is there a tool that will automate some tedious debugging task? Is there a tool that will visualize the effect that something will have? Can we set things up so that people can change the ontology and then instantly see the effect that would have on the problem case they're trying to debug? That sort of, in a way, mundane tool development is a key part of our processes for me.
Thank you very much, Devin, and thank you, Amanda, for teasing out this very important aspect of our Ontology Summit 2013 goals and objectives. And if we look at like the original theme description that Michael Gruninger put together and our co-chairs, then you can see this line that clearly states the summit will seek collaboration with software engineering and knowledge acquisition communities, as those fields have led to several mature models for software life cycle and the design of knowledge based systems, and we expect that fruitful interaction among the participants to lead to a consensus for methodologies within ontological engineering. So if we look at this summit as a part of the process that gets ontology as a domain to mature and to be more ready for prime time, these aspects and insights shared by people like Gavin and Jean would definitely be useful as we look. I mean, when things need to scale, the focus may be totally different, and the tools and the methodologies becomes different too. So probably have chance for maybe one more remark if there's anyone. And if not, I
want to have...
Yes?
Peter, this is Jean.
Who
is it? This is Jean Holm.
Oh, hi, Jean. Yes.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for organizing the session today. I just found it very helpful, and it's great to connect with everybody, and I appreciate the work you've done to organize it.
Thank you very much. We look forward to your joining us, you and everyone else, to join us next week when we have sort of the first round of synthesis that Michael Grinninger and Matthew West will take us through, since we already have like a round of all the tracks already. Next week we will do an interim synthesis as well as open up to explore like the communique and the hackathon and clinics work that might ensue in the second part of the summit. I have one hand from Todd Schneider. Todd? Star 7, Todd?
Thank you, Peter. I have a question for Gavin. Gavin, do you apply this tool for your own internal processes and development?
Which tool?
The capability that you provide for your customers, do you use it internally to help you with your own development?
You mean, I'm sorry, which tool are you referring to?
You mentioned your use of MediaWiki for keeping track of information and providing it. And I was just wondering if you used your own capabilities on your own development processes, i.e. sort of a recursive notion.
Actually, yes. You mean our search engine and so on? We do index our own internal wiki and our own Godzilla repository, and also other places we put documents. So in various formats like PDF and Microsoft Word and so on, so that we can find information using semantic search. Is that what you meant?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. So one more time, thanks to all the panelists for their great presentations, and thanks to everyone for joining us today and for being so enthusiastic in exchanging ideas in the chat room. So join us again same time next Thursday for our Ontology Summit Synthesis 1 session. See you then. Bye-bye.